Let's open in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you again for this chance to come together to open your word, but especially to see how people have opened the soil and looked around and sought to understand your word and illustrate your word. Father, we believe you. We know your word is truth. And so, Father, we seek to understand it. We seek to understand what you mean in it. And we seek to understand better this world in which your redemptive works played out. So guide us tonight. We pray you would watch over this nation and its ongoing unsettled feeling, waiting for final results to come in. And Lord, in all these things, remind us again that your Son Jesus Christ is King. And in all of our anxieties, perhaps, or even celebrations, depending on how we feel about politics, Father, we pray that you would ultimately unite all your people around your Son Jesus Christ, that there might not be division, but instead there would be rejoicing in his great name. And Father, that you would also ultimately remind us that we do not depend upon governments, because those don't change the fact that we're pilgrims in this your world. And so, Father, content us with our pilgrim status and help us to walk faithfully unto that final destination of this new creation. Hear our prayer now for Jesus' sake. Amen. Okay, well, tonight we are looking through a couple of things in our ongoing discussion of archaeology as it relates to the Old Testament. We'll finish up some aspects of the Exodus. And this is, I think, in some ways a trickier portion of the lecture, because the more I review a lot of this stuff, the more confused I get by it. So if you feel confused by some of it, then I guess we're all in good company. Now, there's a lot that goes into some of these issues, particularly this question of the location of Mount Sinai and the location of the Red Sea, as we talked about at the end of last session. Right? We haven't excavated the plaque that says, you know, by Pharaoh's decree, herein is Yam Suf Recreation Area, Red Sea Recreation Area. By the way, those nasty Israelites crossed here. Right, that'd be great, but we don't have anything like that. But instead, we're trying to just understand geography, understand the things that we do know about the ancient world, and hope that that gives us a bit of insight into where we might be narrowing things down. And from there, we'll get into some references to Israel outside of the Bible, and then even start to move into this question of the conquest, of the settlement of the land, and how some of the cities we find relate to the accounts in Joshua. So let's start with this question of the Exodus from Egypt. And in some ways, we're just going to try to narrow down some of the candidates for Mount Sinai. Now, we've talked about travel last week. You'll remember we talked a bit about the direction of travel out of Egypt. Instead of going up the way of Horus, the way of the sea, where all the fortresses were, God brought his people, well, south more. But there's debate about where that is, because in part where the sea is. And we suggested last time that border canal, the frontier canal, that was designed as a defense on that eastern border of Egypt, would have been a significant a barrier for the Israelites. And in fact, that canal also utilized some of these significant lakes, many of which are completely dried up now due to migrations in the Nile, branches of the Nile. Some of those branches have migrated, even over 1,000 years had migrated 15 miles north. Other times they've completely dried up. We just have no sense really which of these great lakes could have been the Red Sea, or Yam Suf as we called it. There have been suggestions that some have claimed to find chariot wheels and coral and those kinds of things down here in the Gulf of Aqaba. First Kings 9, verse 26 does say that Solomon's ships went from Ezion Geber across Yam Suf. Here is usually where Ezion Geber is, and that would suggest this was called Yam Suf. And that has led some people to say, oh, well, that maybe is the same Yam Suf of Exodus, and we should be looking for a crossing here. And some people have come up with ideas. And in some ways, I don't want to dispute some of the possibilities of what they've found. The Patterns of Evidence movies have looked very closely at some of these. And so there's some possibilities. But there's also a bit of a challenge. Of course, the word Yam Suf doesn't necessarily need to be a proper name in terms of like Lake Michigan. You know, that's a pretty defined body of water. If I go south of here to the Lighthouse Restaurant, I don't say I'm having dinner on Lake Michigan. No, I mean, that's a different lake than that one up there. That's Cedar Lake. It's a lot smaller. But you could say maybe Yam Suf, instead of being a title, is something like a great lake. So, well, we could say that's Lake Michigan, or we could call it the Great Lakes, or a great lake. Anyway, you can see how thinking about titles may come into play. We don't know for certain. However, there is this note that the Gulf of Aqaba, as you can see, is some 200 miles away from where the Israelites would have left Ramses there. Now, studies of ancient travel times have been determined from a few different places, and they have noted that one day's journey in the ancient world in a more loaded down kind of setting would be a distance of some 17 to 23 miles. So I think you probably cover more distance in your driving, but just, you can imagine like trying to get freight. You know, it'd be significantly slow, but that's the kind of distance you're traveling. A number of ancient texts will record those travel times between known cities, like up in Mesopotamia and elsewhere. And so that's how they can kind of estimate that you could usually travel around 17 to 23. And actually, an interesting story is in the 1800s, a number of archaeologists were traveling via camel all down here through the Sinai Peninsula, and they found they could go, you know, 10 to 12 hour days, traveling about 2 miles per hour average. And they probably rested and did some other things, but you can see they were maybe traveling 24, 25 miles a day as well. And maybe less if they took longer lunch breaks. So it's just not real clear. But how would that square then with a 200-mile trip to the Gulf of Aqaba? Now, what I've tried to do here is note, you know, approximately what a 25-mile leg would look like per day. And as you can see, if I made these 25 miles, even if I let's just, for the sake of argument, let the Israelites be really speedy. So we're going to have them go a full 25 miles a day. That would be 8 travel days before they're even at the Gulf of Aqaba, where the Red Sea might be. Now, Numbers 33 recounts the travel itinerary of the Israelites in a fairly systematic fashion, and even seems to include a term that a lot of scholars have defined as stage, or a technical term that listed how long one could travel on a given day, a stage of a journey or a stage of a march. What we find then here is these are the stages of the people of Israel when they went out from the land of Egypt by their companies under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Moses went down their starting, wrote down their starting places stage by command of the Lord. And these are their stages according to their starting places. They set out from Ramesses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the people of Israel went out triumphantly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them. On their gods also the Lord executed judgments. And now, look how this list starts out then, indicating these stages, stage by stage, the starting places by each stage. It says, first, the people of Israel set out from Ramesses and camped at Sukkot. So that would seem to indicate day one, a journey. We don't know exactly where Sukkot is. People have tried to guess at a number of things, but that could indicate a journey of, let's say, 25 miles. They set out, verse 6, from Sukkot and camped at Etam, which is on the edge of the wilderness. That would be day two. They set out from Etam and turned back to Pi-Hahirot, which is east of Baal-Zephon, and they camped before Migdol, day three. And then they set out before Hahirot and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness. That seems to be day four. So if the Gulf of Aqaba then was the Red Sea of the Bible, and it did contain Pharaoh's chariots, the host of Israelites, including the women and children, potentially traveled an astonishing 66 miles per day, which you can see each thing here. Our hiccup is that we do have that language where they turned back, it said, on that third day. They turned northward to Pi-Hahiroth. We don't know exactly where that would have been, but for that to be somehow estimated in, I couldn't really think of a way to indicate a northward turn that would really shrink these legs of the journey. But you can see that becomes very problematic. I think some might argue that the word indicating stage actually literally means a pulling up, like a decampment, and maybe it would indicate a period between camping. That becomes a little challenging because, sure, you could say that a decampment happened, and then there were several days of journeying before the next decampment, so you don't have to have them going 60 miles an hour, or 60 miles a day. That'd be a really fast mass of Israelites, 60 miles an hour. They'd all be roadrunners, right? Then they'd get there. But you could perhaps theorize them marching, you know, pulling their tents up, marching, sleeping kind of on the fly, marching the next day, and only putting their camp tents up on the next day. But again, I mean, they're escaping the Egyptians. I have a hard time picturing them sort of getting settled in. The term seems to better indicate a stage of a day's journey, rather than like a reference to a couple of days they got settled in a little more, a couple of days they didn't. So we mention this then simply because where the Red Sea is does affect where we think about where Mount Sinai may have been. If Red Sea, Yam Suf, is up in here, well, then it makes sense to look for Mount Sinai in this region, as it's traditionally been sought. Whereas if it is here, then we would seek to look for Mount Sinai out here in Arabia. Jebel El-Lahaz is a site that has been suggested by some in Saudi Arabia. There has been a long tradition of Sinai being there. Often people cite Galatians 4:25, where Paul says Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds with the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. And so a number some of these people are archaeologists, some are more treasure hunters. They've tried to wander through some of these different mountains in Arabia and see if one might indicate that the Israelites had been there. And you can find a number of different ideas. Sometimes they're a bit fanciful. Some have interpreted some of the standard desert varnish that occurs on rocks. You find this out in the high deserts, California, where I used to go shooting as a kid. You just find this varnish all over the place. It's not literal varnish, but it's that darkening or blackening that you can find. Well, some have interpreted that, that must be the leftover from the fire where God appeared to Israel. Well, it doesn't seem like it, though. Others have posited different sites up here in Arabia that would have been due to this lengthy journey. Another option, some have sought Sinai at at Har Karkom, is a site here, about 55 miles north of modern-day Eilat here. And Har Karkom would fit within that 8 to 11-day time period. That Numbers 33, verses 8 to 15, that goes beyond the verses we read, describes between the journey from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. Here we have, it would fit within that journey, but the thing is, the problems kind of emerge when you see how long it took them to get there, these stages, and now the same word stage is used to indicate the journey from here to here over 11 days. But they would have slowed to something of a snail's pace, covering 32 miles in 11 days, about 3 miles a day. Now, again, that's possible that they would go from really fast travel before Pharaoh's army is destroyed and then slowing it down. They're not in quite as much of a hurry afterwards. But still, it gives a funny reading to those passages. That's one suggestion for looking for Mount Sinai here in the North Sinai Peninsula. Tradition, however, has typically placed Mount Sinai down here in the Sinai Peninsula. And there's language of them camping alongside Yam Suf. That could make sense if Yam Suf was here, that they worked their way south. And this was this whole thing, because again, remember, this was a lengthy canal that was all connected through border lakes and such. Could be that Yam Suf is even being used to designate at this point the Gulf of Suez. By the way, some have suggested that the Gulf of Suez is where the Israelites would have crossed. So I think what we've looked about these bitter lakes is quite compelling, though, in terms of that geography. But that is placed down here in the Sinai, a number of mountains that scholars have suggested could be candidates. It's interesting, though, that there's the St. Catherine's Monastery down at Jebel Musa. That's very famous. It's a very famous pilgrimage site. But it is interesting that we don't read in the Old Testament of regular returns like to Mount Sinai to commemorate. I mean, you might expect that if God had intended his people to really sanctify this one site and pass it on as a memory, but we don't find that. There's a lot of sites we don't find with that, right? We don't, and it kind of, I guess, should curb our enthusiasm or maybe curb our concerns about we really need to find this place because God's people didn't feel the need for a long period of time. But yes, question.
Is there any indication whether the body of water that we're flying up the Red Sea was salt water or fresh water?
Whether it was one or the other?
Yes.
Yeah, the debate. So the debate plays out on a number of ways. We looked at a few terms last time about Yam Suf. The word Suf in Hebrew can mean end. Others have seen it as a related to an Egyptian term for reeds. And so Yam Suf would be the Sea of Reeds. That's, I think, typically how it's translated. But the debate then is that, well, do reeds grow in salt water? That seems like more of a freshwater phenomenon, which is what pushes us toward thinking of the Bitter Lakes as a more likely candidate. And remember, these wouldn't be like, you know, this pond by the seminary. We're not talking like that would be what Pharaoh drowned in. These would be substantial bodies of water. But others have said, well, there are some forms of saltwater reeds, and linguists have debated even whether that word suf is best translated from reed or end from the Egyptian, which would then give them warrant for looking for a saltwater body as well. So you can see why there's a number of different things that you need to kind of untangle to know. But in a way, what this sort of does is it shows us, I guess, a range of things that are going on in thinking through these issues. And it's not just to leave us in the dark, but to show that there's a number of factors that you can weigh against known archaeological points. So, yeah, that'll help answer a bit. I feel like I kind of took your question and wandered a little bit with it too. So,
I was wondering, it would be salt water partway up, mm-hmm. and then it would be mostly fresh after that. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I don't know enough even about the Suez and those lakes, and again I don't know enough about the history of the Nile. You know, that would be a real interesting subject to delve into a bit more, because that would that also would come to bear on that question. Well, again, so archaeology can't always be used to illustrate with the detail that we might wish, but it does provide us with a useful tool in thinking what might have been a boring list of old cities and campsites in Exodus and Numbers, then viewing them as a real itinerary with real stopping points that seem viable based on known travel speeds and ancient topography. And so that's kind of given us some insight into that period. But we move from here into maybe even something a little more concrete when it comes to Israel's history. Now, remember, in Numbers 22, the Israelites had finally arrived at the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And their journey through the wilderness had drawn to a close because the purpose of that 40-year time period, which would involve the deaths of those who rebelled in Numbers 14, that 40-year period had been achieved. And now we have Israel poised to enter the land of promise and to settle it. And this is an exciting period of history. It's very well known due to the dramatic events of Joshua and Judges, but it's also one in which archaeologists and historians have a little more concrete kinds of materials to work with, a little more detailed material to work with. It enables them to illustrate, provide the context, complement in certain ways, and even in some ways confirm the biblical text a little more, just a little stronger than before. So we move into something that's interesting, Israel outside the Bible. Now, we mentioned in a previous class the relationship between the biblical term Hebrew and the term found in the Mari letters, Ivri. And we found that, the Hebrew word for Hebrew is Ivri. And at Mari, they found in these Mari letters this reference to Ivrum, or Ibrum, which was a direct linguistic connection. And that was a fascinating reference that seems to give some insight into the nature of being a Hebrew. We also talked about these Amarna letters from Egypt. And they talked about this group called the Hapiru or the Habiru. And some had tried to connect those to the Hebrews, although there were some linguistic problems. Having said that, though, these letters by these Egyptian pharaohs from 1500 down to 1200 BC were speaking about these sort of rabble groups running around that they weren't real pleased with. And in spite of the linguistic differences, that does describe the kind of group that the Israelites would have been in the eyes of the Egyptians. In fact, a professor I studied with even suggested that that there may be a relationship between Hapiru and Hebrew because sometimes groups will intentionally modify words, kind of to pun on something. Every time I come up with that, I'm sure there's a million great examples I could think of where you take something which could sound one way, but you change one letter and it's clever, it's witty. Now it sounds like something else. That goes from being something kind of villainous to like a famous person, just with a switch of a letter. And again, I can't give you a great example because it's slipping my mind. But that's a possibility too, is that the word Hebrew also sort of puns on that that language, or we just don't know for sure. But nonetheless, we do have mention of the fact that here were these groups of rabble running around. Now, what was very fascinating is that in 1896, Sir Flinders Petrie discovered a stela in the Valley of Kings down in Thebes. And it was commissioned by Pharaoh Merneptah, who reigned in the late 13th century BC. And Pharaoh Merneptah spent a bunch of time here celebrating his victories and describing a number of cities and peoples that he conquered. It's a very boasting kind of text. But what's very fascinating is this ending section of the stele, which says this: "The princes are prostrate, saying mercy. Not one raises his head against the nine bows. Desolation is for Tehenu. Hatti is pacified. Plundered is the Canaan with every evil. Carried off as Ashkelon. Seized upon in Gezer. Yanoam is made as that which does not exist. Israel is laid waste. His seed is not." Wow, well, that's interesting. Here is all these different cities. We know some of them from the Bible: Ashkelon, Gezer, Canaan as the region even. Some other groups, well, Hatti would be the land of the Hittites. But we have all this language, and then suddenly this reference down there to Israel. This is a very fascinating thing. Because this reference to Israel, and this is the hieroglyphs that are used in this portion here, what's fascinating is that here we have a number of cities and regions being described, but when it gets to Israel, it uses a special determinative marker. Some of these ancient languages where it would use a little mark, where if it wanted to distinguish between a city, let's say, or distinguish between a group, or just, you know, they would put a different mark on the front of the word. In Akkadian, there's a sign called the dingir, which they put right before the name of a god. And so you have a dingir sign will indicate, oh, this next name is a divine name. What's fascinating is the determinative used is a determinative to indicate a people group rather than a settled group or like a nation. And so while Merneptah has exaggerated his accomplishments, claiming to have utterly wiped out this people, Israel, this reference has convinced even critical scholars that the conclusion that this inscription has been considered correctly as concrete proof of an Israel in Palestine around 1200 BC remains the most reasonable one, right? He wouldn't be talking about having caused some trouble to this group if they weren't a formidable group of people located in approximately this area. And so Israel was a substantial enough force to be identified as a people and then boasted about on an Egyptian stele in perfect harmony with the biblical record. For some time, the critics, remember, had claimed that the Israelites were simply a disenfranchised group of Canaanites who sort of worked their way together back up in the land of Canaan. And then they came together after the collapse of the Late Bronze Age and invented a fictitious history of having escaped from Egypt and settled in Canaan. But the Merneptah stele has made this critical story a bit harder to believe. And though critics still deny the historicity of the Exodus and the time before, they're at least now forced to reckon with an Israel that had sufficient homogeneity and sufficient solidarity to be established as a fighting force and listed as such by a pharaoh much earlier than the critical theories would prefer. So that's a fascinating example there of Israel located in Egypt, I mean, in Thebes, way back by the Nile, but speaking of this people that have been he's boasting that he laid it waste, but I mean, Israel was still there. So pharaohs did that kind of thing. People will say, well, if Pharaoh died in the Red Sea, why don't we read anything about that? It's like, well, pharaohs don't typically boast about getting defeated. There's debate about whether Pharaoh himself would have died in the Red Sea. Obviously, if he had died, well, there's the reason he didn't write anything about that. You don't do a lot of writing after death. But if he, even if he hadn't died, that's not the kind of thing. I know, you know, hey, scribe, come and build a beautiful statue of my defeat by that God Yahweh who drowned all my best army troops, right? No, not likely. Just not so likely. But all right. What we'll do is move a little forward. I've talked about this this issue of dating a bit. And even just now we have this, I just made reference to the fact that this is a 13th century reference. Well, what do we have going on here? There's a bit of debate, even among conservative believing Bible scholars, about when this date actually happened. They're in full agreement about the historicity of this event, that there was an exodus from Egypt, there was a settlement from Canaan, but there's some debate about when that happened. Now, knowing when it happened might seem to be an important thing for a number of reasons, right? But we'll find that this ambiguity in the end actually kind of helps us as well, at least as we talk with people who are very critical of these various things. But here's why it might be helpful to know. If one is excavating a site, it looks like an army came through, they find carbon 14 dates, or they find scarabs that indicate a date in the 15th century, that would then make us say, well, that seems to fit perhaps an Israelite invasion of that city. However, if one believes that the date happened in the 13th century, well, then that wouldn't be quite as important of a site for what they're trying to wrestle with. Well, in order to settle this debate, people need to come up with something of a benchmark. two different benchmarks end up being used. For people who hold to this early date, they point to 1 Kings 6, verse 1. That reads, "In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord." And so if Solomon's reign, if the fourth year of Solomon's reign was 966 BC, which is well attested by both parties in the debate, not much dispute over that point, 480 years prior would be around 1446 BC, a date in the 15th century. This is called the early date. Now, some who hold to a late date, who believe that it was the 13th century when Israel left Egypt, of course, that involves a different set of pharaohs, a different set of things like that, but they would point to Exodus 1, verse 11, where we read that the Israelites built for Pharaoh store cities, Pitom and Ramesses. Now, Ramesses II reigned in Egypt from around 1279 to 1213 BC, and that would suggest that Ramesses II was the pharaoh of the Exodus, yielding a date for the event in the 13th century. See how both groups are turning to Scripture, looking for a benchmark to try to make sense. When should we be looking for these events to have taken place? Now, what's interesting about the late date is this was a time of massive building projects in Egypt that would require a large workforce, and we don't find that as evident in the 15th century BC. Not that it's absent, but at least we haven't. It's not as pronounced. Also, in the 13th century, Egypt had begun to lose control of Canaan, which was not the case in the 15th century. And so, scholars have suggested it's harder to imagine Israel heading toward Egyptian strongholds in a time when Egypt is, you know, in that 15th century. Now, there's a lot of knots that we could untie, that we'd be here all night just looking at verses and math, and we'd have our calculators out and doing stuff like that. There's criticism to be leveled at each position's appeal to Scripture, and there's rejoinders to be given to each of those criticisms. And so I think the best thing we can do is sort of make a few observations that can at least orient us to some of the issues and think through this about where how some of these things may get resolved. Maybe I should just, do y'all want to know just what I think? I lean toward that earlier date. I find a lot of things more compelling, and I'll say more in just a moment. But having said that, there's some very, very fine Bible-believing scholars who hold to the later date. So, and I'll explain how they do that. First of all, the problem that both dates have is the chronology of the judges. This is a tricky thing. The book of Judges lists all these different judges and the number of years they judged, right? Well, determining the length of the period of the judges then would seem just as easy as looking up the judge, making a big long list of every all the years you see, adding them all up, and boom, there's your number. But the problem is it hasn't actually yielded good results. People who have done that run the gamut from 515 years to 633 years for the period of the judges. And that's not just because they're bad at mathematics. It's because the numbers given in Judges are not really presented in a really clear, straightforward fashion. Difficult interpretive decisions are made by anybody who's working through these numbers. Even if you took 515 years, okay, the lowest number, even if you took that lowest number and you said that was the correct way to deal with the period of the judges, that would put the Exodus around the 17th century BC. I mean, nobody believes that. Nobody's appealing to Exodus or to 1 Kings claiming that, well, actually, it's a 17th century Exodus. Now, that's far too early for anyone's standards. Both recognize that establishing the biblical chronology is not as basic as just citing a single verse and then counting backwards. So you have to posit overlaps among the judges. And that's how everybody has dealt with that. That's a very reasonable decision. However, deciding which judges you're going to place in overlapping judgeships depends largely upon which passage of Scripture you're using as that benchmark. Okay? So you'll say, well, I'm going to use this as the benchmark, and then the other passage I'm going to deal with a different way, or vice versa. So, for example, If you took 1 Kings 6, 1, or if let's say if you took Exodus 1, verse 11 as the benchmark, what you would then suggest is that the that number we read in 1 Kings 6, 1 is actually more of a round or symbolic number. A number of you know, it's something like a bunch of different blocks of 40 years, 40-year periods that are all stacked together. So if you want the Exodus date, speaking of Pitom and Ramesses, and you want to say that's referring to Ramesses 2, which is a reasonable thing to infer, well, then you say this is a kind of a symbolic number described in 1 Kings. If, on the other hand, you want to say, no, I think that 1 Kings is giving us a concrete number of that puts us into the 15th century, what you would then do is treat the name of the store cities Ramesses as one of these anachronisms used to help remind the people of Israel of what this place is now called. Now, usually we find updated names in the Bible indicated, right? It'll say such and such a place that is such and such another name, right? It'll give both names, but that's not absolutely required. And so that's, I think, a very reasonable possibility there. Well, I actually had written out that full paragraph. I could have just read that. That would have simplified that whole thing, right? So, but it goes to show that this is kind of the challenge in dealing with either of these dates, are the period of the judges. Another issue that comes up for both groups is the archaeological data, right? Major destructions at key sites are found in both the 15th and the 13th centuries, as is the case with Hazor. We'll say more about Hazor probably next week. But it should be noted that most of the 13th century destructions were followed by brand new city plans, brand new settlement plans, which you can easily attribute to new settlers, right? If you have a city, it's kind of like if I kicked you out of your house and moved in, probably after a few months, it's going to look more like my preferences than it did yours, right? So this makes sense that you would have a destroyed city rebuilt along different lines. But on the other hand, 15th century dates, destruction layers that we find, often were followed by a very similar city plan. But look, Deuteronomy 6 verses 10 and 11 tells us, when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, ... Well, all of a sudden, we see that it's not necessarily a surprise for us to think about Israelites destroying a city, maybe not burning it completely, but destroying it, doing what they needed to do, and then saving time and effort to basically rebuild it and get it back in order for them to live in. Because God said you would be living in cities you did not build, having cisterns that you did not dig yourselves. Why destroy it all? And then spend all your resources doing that. So the archaeological data can be mustered both directions. And then another point, a third and final point, is just the difficulty in various identification of sites. Now, an example is the site of Ai. And we'll say more about this in just a moment. But Ai is traditionally assigned to a place called Et Tel. However, at Et Tel, they have found neither a 15th nor a 13th century destruction. And so, well, wait a minute. This is one of those cities that the Bible explicitly says was burned. What do we do with that? Why don't we find anything there? Now, of course, that doesn't exactly challenge the account, because the Hebrew name Ai literally means the ruin, and it might indicate a well-defended encampment along the ruins of a Middle Bronze Age city, so it's not a big deal that they haven't found a burn layer there. But another thing that's interesting is there is another site nearby called Kirbet el-Makatir, and 15th century ruins have been found there. Although, the problem is that once you do that, you actually need to relocate Bethel. I can show you a map here, right? Here is Et Tel, this little star down here. I put Jericho here. I put the wrong thing. That's not where Tel Jericho was. That's down here some more. But right here is Et Tel, which is connected not far from Biton, which is traditionally Bethel. However, this other site, Kirbet El Makatir, is a little far over from Biden, and instead, the people who placed Kirbet El Makatir here suggest that Al-Biray was Bethel. So there's some debates. If you start moving one site, you sometimes have to start moving other sites as well. And it's kind of heavily debated about whether Biray is as likely of a candidate as Biden for Bethel. But anyway, you can see how you can see just some of the issues involved in looking at the different dates here and why it's hard to settle on one date or the other in a number of these cases. The truth is out there, and here's what where I'll leave it with. The truth is out there. Either the Israelites entered the land in the 15th century or they entered the land in the 13th century, right? We're not claiming that. Well, it's just both. We'll just be happy, right? Well, now that works for some postmoderns, but it just doesn't work for real life. Unfortunately, we're currently at something of a scholarly stalemate. We've been there a long time, and I think we will be there for a long time. There's going to be, who knows what we'll uncover, though. And maybe new data will help arbitrate the debate, but until then, we'll content ourselves with these two options. And as I'll show in a little bit, I think those actually serve us well and give us something of an edge when we're talking with people who are disputing some of these points. Let's do this. We'll take our break. It's about, 12 after or something? Because I think that way what we'll do is we'll pivot from here into the actual settlement in the land. And then we'll look at specifically Jericho and back to Ai, wherever Ai is, and think through some of those topics a bit. So let's take 5 minutes or so, and we'll take our break. Okay, Israel's settlement in the land. We talked a couple classes ago about the way archaeology has served as the occasion to restudy the details of Scripture from time to time. So that older scholarship, both conservative and liberal, but older scholarship viewed the events of Joshua as a sort of blitzkrieg, scorched earth campaign throughout the land of Canaan. And coupled with that was then an attempt by archaeologists to associate destruction layers at nearly every site throughout the land and associate it with the Israelite conquest. And so William Albright, famously of Johns Hopkins University, tried to attribute the 13th century destructions of places like Bethel and Debir, Eglon and Lachish, all to the Israelites. And early date scholars disagreed with the relevance of that data, but others noted that there are several cities mentioned in Joshua whose archaeological remains do not show evidence of a fiery conflagration of the site. Now, scholars dealt with that in a number of ways. Right, some continued to attribute these burn layers to the Israelites, even where other data mitigated against doing so. But others turned to different settlement models altogether. And so you had Albright's conquest blitzkrieg model. But there was another way called the peaceful infiltration model, proposed by George Mendenhall of University of Michigan, who suggested that actually, and this moves away from the biblical storyline. We'll just explain how some of this works. They move away from the biblical storyline. They say, well, there were these groups of Semitic peoples who entered into the land slowly over a long period of time, happily joined the Canaanites, and only later wrote a bunch of dramatic stories about having a shared ancestry and conquering the land. Bada bing, bada boom. We got that solved. Okay, complete full infiltration model. Others went a different route and said, well, no, there's a revolt aspect. And so Norman Gottwald proposed a peasant revolt model whereby an oppressed class of Canaanite citizens cast off their yokes and staged a few damaging riots and then settled into some new homes, new cities. And one thing to be noted, if that sounds like Karl Marx, that's exactly what it is. And that was exactly what Norman Gottwald was trying to do, was apply a Marxist model to this approach of the settlement of the land. A more recent archaeologist, Israel Finkelstein, suggested something I've heard termed now as the agricultural resettlement of pastoralist groups model. Now, that's kind of a mouthful. But what he's trying to do is he's noting that there is an explosion of new sites in the Iron One period, which is this period approximately when everything is getting settled down. And he notes that things like droughts, other factors probably caused nomadic groups to settle down into townships. Sometimes there were some conflicts, there were some riots and breakdown of some relationships of cities that explains some of the burn layers. But the key difference is that the peasant revolt model was a conflict-driven model, whereas this is trying to have a more organic model. But the problem with all of these is that they pay insufficient attention to the biblical task, or biblical text, rather. A better tack, however, is to return to the scriptures and ask, well, has anything been taken for granted or wrongly assumed? Now, again, we've talked a bit about this. When you read the battle accounts of Joshua, there are many cities that are mentioned. But though many of the cities were attacked, only three were said to have been burned by fire. And that leads to what James Hoffmeyer calls something like a limited conquest of strategic areas. So you see how he's drawing on that conquest language, because we do have battles. But he's pushing away from that blitzkrieg scorched earth kind of thing that didn't end up holding up, and going to the text and saying, what do we know for certain? Now, we do find Joshua 6:24 says Jericho was burned, Ai in Joshua 8:28 was burned, and Hazor in 11:11 was burned. And we find in Joshua 11, verses 12 and 13, a little more information. All the cities of those kings and all their kings Joshua captured and struck them with the edge of the sword, devoting them to destruction, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. But none of the cities that stood on mounds did Israel burn, except Hazor alone. That Joshua burned. So you can already see the Bible should have been steering people away from looking for, at least in the north, where Hazor was, the northern campaign. They should have just given up trying to find burn layers and associate it with the Israelites. Maybe there had been some fire, but that wasn't what we even found in the text. Now, Jericho, of course, would have been a mound, but Jericho was in the south. This campaign, this passage is speaking about the north. But this is exactly what you would expect of a people who intended to conquer a city and then move in immediately. So rather than burn the city and destroy it, only to immediately expend all kinds of time and resources reconstructing it, right, to reconstruct a city. I mean, the reason you get these mounds is because you've got all this rubble, and you got to decide, well, do we save some of these walls and rocks, move certain things, add a new floor, stamp it all down, everything gets raised a few feet, right? That's a lot of effort. Takes a lot of, you got to find new stones from elsewhere to start building in the walls because you can't salvage everything. Why do that? Remember, that was what we read in Deuteronomy 6:10 to 11 about the cities you did not build. Right, this makes sense that we wouldn't find burn layers all over, and it makes sense why these were the only sites that were burned. It was very limited, and it was strategic. Let's do this. From here, what we'll do is look a little more closely at the cities that are described as having been burned by fire, because Jericho and Ai in particular have elicited much debate due to archaeological challenges. Now, with Jericho and Ai in particular, a lot is sort of riding on these sites in terms of making this defense of biblical history. And so anytime you have a lot riding on something, you can make overstatements, right? We're finding this in a lot of media sources right now. We got one side of the equation, really, I mean, they've got a lot riding on this, let's say, on the counts of the ballots or something, right? And they're going to be making claims like, no, it's impossible that any votes could ever be counted wrong. Impossible? I mean, that's not impossible. There may be some pretty solid evidence showing some problems here, right? And you got others on the other side, right, who maybe are going to pick a different issue and say, this has to be going on because this, that, and the other thing. And you have to say, well, wait a minute. Is that reasonable? I know you're passionate about it, but are we sure that it needs to be that way? When there's a lot riding on something, we can be prone to kind of overplay our hand, as it were. Well, overstatements have been made about Jericho and Ai. They haven't helped the believing cause. So what we'll do is survey these sites and try to articulate a responsible way of discussing that array of evidence that has been yielded via the archaeological excavations. And what we're going to see with Jericho, again, and with Ai, is the way in which these remains do synchronize very well with the Bible's description of Israel's entry into the land. So first of all, Jericho. Joshua fought the battle. I was going to put a graphic up, of all the, you can find all kinds of books from the Sunday school materials showing everything. But there's hardly a more well-known story in the whole of Scripture than that of the spies and Rahab and Jericho and Joshua in and out of the city, in Joshua 2 and in Joshua 6. Now, because of various details of Jericho that are found in the story, right, you read of the fortification walls. We read of there being a gate in Jericho. We read of a housing that is built into the city walls. Because of all these details, finding and excavating Jericho has long been viewed as a way to correlate the text of Scripture with artifacts on the ground. And I think there actually is some good correlation. But having said this, what's very interesting is that most critical scholars view Jericho as a hallmark example of how archaeology disproves the Bible. How does that work out? How do we respond to this? Well, here's how this works out. Jericho has traditionally been located here at Tell es-Sultan. Scholars who are both conservative and liberal have accepted this traditional location. So to that question earlier, right? This is the city. There it is. You can see the mound along here. It's pretty thrashed because it's such a famous destination. In fact, nowadays it looks like there's even like a gondola kind of ride. You can go up above the site up into the hills because Jericho's right against the sheer ridge of kind of a desert outcropping there. Here's the site. It's been long studied, long looked at. Now, early work was done in the late 1800s and then from 1907 to 1913, and that material hasn't yielded too much that's directly of note, but it's really with the excavations of John Garstang in the 1930s that we really begin to see things related to the Bible, or at least how it relates to the biblical story played out in a lot of detail. Garstang found a collapsed double wall on the summit of the Tell, and he dated it to the late 15th century BC. And he then said these were the fallen walls of Joshua 6. Now, as you can see, not quite two decades later, Kathleen Kenyon came to Jericho in an effort to clarify Garstang's work at the site. And Kenyon had an incredible advancements that she worked out. They call it the Wheeler-Kenyon method, where when you often see sites with big squares all over the place, that's due to the Wheeler-Kenyon method. It's a way of controlling the dig so that you're not just like, it wouldn't be like digging and we're going to dig out this little stage area here until we're done and we can step back and go, we've dug out a stage. The Wheeler-Kenyon method would have let's say you started digging, but you were in your little box. You would dig, and you would note this corner of the stage, and you would mark it in your information, and then you would move on, and you'd go dig deeper, and you'd mark those things. And the person next to you would mark the other part. And you don't have to be doing it quite at the same time. You could, but it allows you to be more controlled in determining what features belong together and which ones belong at different areas. So it was a very precise way of working through these sites and digging in a controlled, observable way. Well, she did this method, and she concluded that Garstang's double wall actually dated from some 1,000 years earlier, from the early Bronze period, and that the city fell actually some 100 years before Joshua had even arrived. And so that all that would have been in existence when Joshua arrived, if anything, would have been something of just a squatter camp. It certainly wouldn't have been a walled fortress with a king. And so Kenyon's work is considered the definitive treatment of Jericho's history by nearly everyone who denies the historicity of Joshua 6. So you see an interesting thing going on. Garstang making a proposal about certain walls, about the fall of the city that sounds very biblical. Kenyon coming, revisiting a lot of that, and coming up with very different results. Now, believing scholars have responded to this situation in a couple of different ways. So, the 15th century dates, for those people who hold to an early date, this is well represented by Bryant Wood. Bryant Wood is a pottery specialist who had gone back and challenged Kenyon's dating of the site. And part of it is he noted that Kenyon died before completing a final report of her excavations. Right? She put all this time into the site, but never was able to come around and actually really get a report in as clean and as polished of a way as possible. Nowadays, you can go, for example, to the Oriental Institute website, the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, which has a wonderful museum full of pottery from Megiddo, pottery from the ancient Near East, incredible statuary, wonderful museum, not too far. Someday it'll be open again. We can all go there. If you go onto their website, even, you can see many of the books, many of their volumes that'll be site reports, published final site reports. And it'll contain page after page of information about the finds, thorough write-ups about the pottery they discovered. It'll have hand drawings of the thickness of the pottery and the shape. It'll have pictures, they call them plates, of the different things themselves. And they're very thorough, precise, scholarly works. Those books in print can cost $200 a book. You know, and if you have a site like Megiddo that has something like six volumes or whatever, you're spending a lot of money for these reports. They're very high-end works. Kenyon never was able to publish one of those for Jericho. Instead, her final reports were posthumously published, and they lacked Kenyon's own explanations of how she interpreted the pottery that she discovered. So what Wood did is he pieced together a bunch of scattered statements and various writings and found he was able to see that Kenyon's disagreement with Garstang's dating of the site was based on the absence of imported Cypriot pottery. Here's some examples of this painted Cypriot pottery, which often was imported during certain periods, and then that can help you determine whether or not when things would have been happening, when there might have been a relationship. Think of it this way. Here again, when I try to think of a nice illustration, I blank. But you could imagine if there was a time, let's say we enter into a period where we go to complete war with Canada and there's never any more connections between Canada and America, and we start finding that in our archaeological record, there's no more Canadian things. There's not a lot of hockey jerseys anymore. We're not drinking as much maple syrup here, right? You could pick anything like that. And you would say, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. There's no longer any connections, so the lack of it makes sense. If I come to an area, oh, look at that, there's no hockey jerseys here. I'd expect to find hockey jerseys. Maybe this is after the time of the great Canada-U.S. war. Yeah, I'll quit trying to illustrate. You're following. You get it. So, okay. Well, this Cypriot pottery was often used to show dating. And Kenyon noted that she disagreed with Garstang and dated the site because it lacked this kind of Cypriot pottery. This is some shards that Wood himself found at Jericho, incidentally. And he'll say a little more about that. Now, again, we've mentioned that comment, the absence of evidence is not necessarily evidence of absence, right? Just because it's hard to argue about something by what is lacking there. However, the absence of Cypriot ware can be an important indicator about the date of a given archaeological stratum. And yet we also need to be careful about drawing conclusions based on what wasn't found somewhere, because There could be all kinds of reasons why something is missing. Once Wood sorted through the local pottery types, though, he did discover a few pretty important things. First of all, Kenyon had not only failed to appreciate the importance of she failed to appreciate the importance of the pottery she did uncover. There was a great deal of ordinary pottery that Bryant Wood has said is appropriate to the 15th century BC. So she didn't really take stock of that really ordinary kind of ware. And that actually is the more common stuff and the more controlled stuff, because pottery develops, it has its own style, and it slowly develops over time. It's not a precise, perfect kind of thing, but what he found is very much in accord with the 15th century. So Kenyon didn't appreciate what pottery she did find. Secondly, Kenyon had excavated in an unusually impoverished area on the site. Right? Every town has areas that are wealthier and less wealthy, and fancy imported wares are not the kind of things you'll necessarily find at the poorer parts of a site like that. So why would that be the reason for determining that the site couldn't have been in existence at that point? And then third, Wood notes that Garstang had actually uncovered Cypriot bichromeware, this imported Cypriot pottery type. It's just that when Garstang excavated, and remember, he excavated in the 30s, when Garstang excavated, the importance of this kind of pottery wasn't recognized as being significant for dating. And so a lot of the times, it was just published along with all the other ordinary pottery, right? So that it didn't look like he had singled anything out. You just had to really sift through things to find it. And in fact, Cypriot pottery has shown up in erosion layers, even though these erosion layers were south of where Kenyon excavated. So we do seem to have some Cypriot pottery. We do seem to have some things that would have dated it to the 15th century, after all. Now, there's some challenges about the actual location of those pieces of pottery, but nonetheless, there's some things that Kenyon overlooked that need to be rethought. Another thing, she rightly rejected Garstang's interpretation of this so-called double wall. However, Kenyon unearthed a stone revetment wall and a mud brick parapet wall that would have surrounded the city before its 15th century destruction. Now here is, you can see this giant wall here next to this excavator. This is this section here. And the thing with a wall like this is a lot of fortifications would create something of like a retaining wall, and it would be firm and built stones. And on top of that retaining wall, sometimes they'd plaster it and make what's called a glacis as part of the fortifications. They would then build a straight wall or some type of wall above that. Some walls would be thick. We find sites with walls that are 15 feet thick. I'll show you one next week found from the time of Hezekiah preparing for the Assyrian invasion. They call it the broad wall because it's broad, all right. It's a big wall. Other times a wall would be what would they call the casemate wall, where it would be kind of like narrower walls that enclosed buildings or rooms or houses, which could explain Rahab's situation. She lived in the wall. That could mean she lived between different portions of walls, but nonetheless, there's casemate walls they find as well. Well, here is this wall that she discovered, and she also found in this look, right, as she was working through, and she cut this trench that showed all these different layers. Along with it, there was this large triangular flow of destroyed red bricks. And what it looks like is that this wall had stood upon the top of this this revetment wall here, and in some type of earthquake or cataclysmic event, an earthquake seems most reasonable, this wall fell in and scattered out into this shape like that, which, of course, would give a nice ramp for an army to go up into the city, as Joshua 6:20 says, and it makes a lot of sense why this would all be here. And she noticed just the number of different layers in all of this. And so this seems like this would have been a wall that would have been in place prior to that 15th century destruction. I know these are kind of tricky to look at with all those different layers, but I mean, imagine if we were digging and we just kept digging down, and along the wall we would see, you know, okay, look at that, all this brick, and now the soil changes. Now it's gravelly. So this looks like this maybe was here when all this fell into place. And, you know, there's things on top of that. And they would find in other places large sections where there would be black burned coals, charcoal still, some organic matter, a number of things like that. So you can see how this is telling us a story of what happened at the site. There was a wall that crashed outward. Incidentally, when Lachish fell to the Assyrians, they sent siege engines up on the wall. And, of course, the siege engines push the walls in. For these walls to fall out indicates earthquake or, you know, in our case, divinely caused earthquake. But, right? All right. Interestingly, among the burnt city were found a significant amount of burnt grain in storage jars. These are large pithoi. They didn't use, they didn't have like Tupperware or, they didn't go buy Rubbermaids from Menards. They had pithoi. There were these giant pots that they could store water in, or you could store grain in. Well, they found all these pithoi from this same time period with significant amount of burnt grain. Now, if the city, which had been destroyed, nobody disputes this, if it had been destroyed in a siege, well, the grain would have been gone because they would have eaten all the grain. Battle, they would have had the attack after they were pretty starved out. So that doesn't explain why there's all this burnt grain here. If the city had been destroyed in a fierce battle from, let's say, the Egyptians, the grain would have been taken and used to feed the army. Grain was pretty important stuff, quite a commodity. And so it's puzzling that there's grain found here. However, we do know that Israel was told to devote the city and to not plunder it. And actually, this does seem to then make a lot of sense. A scenario where an army destroyed a city, burned it, but didn't actually take even these important things, right? Again, that's a fairly reasonable, I think, correlation. But full disclosure, it's very debated still. Now, there's a lot of reasons why things are debated. They're not always legitimate why they're debating it. So I think so far we've seen some really helpful things that really correlate. One other thing that was very fascinating, a cemetery just outside Jericho yielded a continuous series of Egyptian scarabs from the 18th through early 14th centuries B.C. A scarab would show kind of like the name of a given pharaoh, or in this case, the princess. Right, we have some scarabs here from Amenhotep III. We have some from Thutmose III. We have one from Hatshepsut, right? And so you can see some of these scarabs, but these are only four. But there was a whole series of these. And that would contradict Kenyon's claim that the city was abandoned after 1550 BC, because we have scarabs from the cemetery that's at work going on. Now, sometimes it has been suggested, and this isn't completely wrong, a cemetery may be an outpost, and even if there's nobody living at a city, people travel to their traditional family tomb, right? That's possible. However, we at least know that this is an active cemetery being used that show indication of these Egyptian scarabs. And so it's reasonable to see the city as fitting, as being in existence as well. Now, how have critics dealt with Wood? Most of them have responded to Wood by ignoring his work. Okay, so most critics just completely ignore him. Now, some are reticent to give credence to a view that actually supports the biblical text, and that's why they ignore him. They've written him off as some wacko conservative fundamentalist, and they're not going to pay attention to him because he's not doing rigorous work. That's pretty unfair. On the other hand, some are skeptical of whether Wood's work was sufficiently rigorous because of the fact that he published it in a more popular magazine called Biblical Archaeology Review rather than in one of the more, what you might call, top-tier academic research journals like the journal Tel Aviv or Palestinian PEQ, I think was the name of it, something Palestinian Excavation Quarterly, or there's some German journals as well, Zeitschrift für die Deutsche Palästinian Vereins or something. There's a number of these high-end kinds of journals that are rigorous, and why didn't he publish there, they'll say. Why did he put it in the Biblical Archaeology Review? Well, look, regardless, several scholars, including some who disagree with Wood's 15th century dating scheme, several scholars have recognized that Wood has reopened the discussion and that you can't come up with these excuses. You have to deal with it. Take him to task then on his interpretation of this grain or these seals or this pottery. You can't just write him off. That's just not rigorous academic work. Now, what about if we haven't settled this? What about the 13th century? Well, here's the interesting thing. A different approach is taken to Jericho by those who hold to the 13th century Exodus and settlement. Two believing scholars, Kenneth Kitchen and Ralph Hawkins, have drawn attention to one of Kenyon's highly significant, although overlooked admissions, the possibility that a small town may have been built on the ruins of the Middle Bronze Age site, yet had since been destroyed by erosion. Now, Kenyon had stressed that this site had been severely damaged by erosion. And the portrait I even showed you looked just pretty bald. It's not a really, it's not as well-preserved of a site as a whole bunch of other places. And so that's a very reasonable conclusion. Critics should be much more cautious about denying the presence of a 13th century city because of the possibility of this erosion. In fact, Kenneth Kitchen concludes this: if 200 years of erosion suffice to remove most of the later Middle Bronze Age Jericho, it's almost a miracle that anything on the mound has survived at all from the 400 years of erosion between 1275 and the time of Ahab, when we hear the report of Jericho's rebuilding. It is for this reason, and not mere harmonization, that this factor must be given its due weight, right? He's trying to say, we're not just trying to like reach out and make a cheap harmonization to win the debate. He says, no, it's for this reason that we need to do this. There may well have been a Jericho during 1275 and 1220, but it was located above the tiny remains of the earlier ruins, and all of this has long, long since gone. We will never find Joshua's Jericho for that very simple reason. This is a very fair point. If you find that a site has been decimated, and you find consistently across it is lacking the very period you're looking for, it's very reasonable to say, look, we're not going to find this. This really is the case in a lot of places in Jerusalem even, where there's certain things we would really like to find, except the problem is that the Romans, when they came through, the Romans liked to dig down to bedrock and rebuild from there. Well, what do you do when you dug down to bedrock? You've just destroyed everything we might have found, right? And so this is a good, reasonable solution here. And so in the end, an honest, critical scholar will admit that Tell us Sultan does not disprove the stories of Joshua 2-6. May support it, but it at least doesn't disprove it, okay? Even Amihai Mazar, who's written kind of the standard archaeology textbook used by critical scholars, concludes that in the case of Jericho, the archaeological data cannot serve as decisive evidence to deny a historical nucleus to the Book of Joshua concerning the conquest of the city. I mean, he's not writing as a very conservative type of, you know, person there. That's not why I'm putting that quote up there, because I think we'd want to quibble with some points. But it still raises an interesting thing that the standard work that archaeologists around the world are cutting their teeth on is telling them that Jericho can't serve as the evidence if you're going to deny the story. And as we've seen, there's very compelling things that point us toward accepting it. We've not sought to settle the debate between the 15th and 6th and 13th centuries. Although you can see again, I'm tilting my hand a little bit toward, I find that 15th century date compelling. I also find it easier to fit that whole period of the judges into the larger amount of time. There's a lot more kinds of synchronizations that make judges harder to read. But I respect the believing scholars who do so while at the same time holding the scriptures inerrancy. But anyway, but here's the neat thing, and here's the way to look at this, right? either schema, archaeological evidence does not undermine the historicity of the text, and indeed, this debate makes the task of the critical scholar that much more daunting. For them to argue, then, that they've disproved the Bible, first of all, they have to settle the dating issue. Good luck to you. Good luck settling that issue. Tell us when you get that verdict in. And only then can they muster evidence and data in support of their position. So do you see why, for now, having this disagreement on the two dates makes it that much harder for critics to really try to poke holes in this? Any questions on that? Otherwise, we'll spend just our last few minutes looking at AI.
Yeah, got a question online.
Yes.
Not specifically related to Casey Bissett wrote in. Could you explain what cities on mounds mean? Is mounds a reference to older cities where remnants were built over?
Yeah, cities on mounds.
This says the cities would then appear to be on a small hill, even in Joshua's time. He's asking, would there be that much of it?
Yeah, so a city on a mound is, good question, Casey. You do find cities where they weren't in existence very long, and it was just built on pretty much the plain. They'll find some stones and evidence of buildings and all. When they talk about a mound, usually it's because it's been a site with many, many, many years of history where there's been building and destructions and rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding. And it forms a very prominent shape, you know, of a city that goes up, and it's the city up there. And it's built upon the destructions of many cities prior. You could put a city up on a hill, but it's not typically how they think of the word, like of a mound city. So I hopefully that helps. I know you're on, if you're watching, you guys are on about a 45-second delay. So if you have a follow-up question, it'll take a minute to get to that. But good question. Let's look just a few moments at AI. I mentioned ETEL, and we had that challenge of showing the location of AI. Is it at ETEL or is it somewhere else? Right, they suggested ETEL here shows no evidence for 15th or 13th century, but when Edward Robinson began looking for sites near ETEL, he was told about a site 1 mile southeast of ETEL called Kirbet el Maqatir. And locals actually claimed it was biblical AI, yet his initial survey thought it was just kind of popular lore. But when he got to Maqatir in 1981, the site was explored, and it yielded some pottery from the Bronze Age. And so in 1990, Bryant Wood and a number of others explored the site, found ancient walls, and prompted him to begin excavations in 1995. Maqatir was well fortified until it was destroyed and burned in the 15th century, and so Wood and others believed that biblical AI should be sought here and not at ETEL. Now, what's interesting is Ralph Hawkins, who we cited a moment ago, a defender of the 13th century date, he holds that 13th century date, and so he would seem to have little interest in a site that claims to exhibit 15th century destruction. But it's interesting that Hawkins himself admits that Kirbet el Maqatir is an intriguing possibility, whose pottery does indeed cohere well with an early date Exodus conquest. But scholars, including Hawkins, have been slow to relinquish ETEL. After all, making the shift to Kirbet el Maqatir requires one to shift the location from biblical Bethel from the site of Beit el Bira, as we noted earlier. There's ETEL related to Beit, here's Maqatir related to Bel Bira, and both of these incidentally are up. Here's Jericho up here into the hills a little bit. And yet, even if unequivocal proof were to emerge locating AI at ETEL, a close reading of Joshua 7 and 8 still corresponds well with archaeological data. So there's a few different things here. This, incidentally, was just a reconstruction, but based on some of this work. And incidentally, there's those squares also that we were talking about as part of the Wheeler-Kenyon method. See how, like, there's a, like, that wall kind of goes, and then it goes into, like, nothing? That's not because somebody just designed a dumb room. That's because those are at different levels. And in the end, it works out, but it controls that very nicely. Well, there's also Kirbit Nicaea is another site where this has been suggested. One thing that's interesting, though, and let's do this. With AI, we hear of this battle. And I think when we think of the city of AI, we can lose sight of the fact that AI literally means the ruin. It's called the ruin. They attacked the ruin. The Hebrew word for city, though, doesn't always mean a major metropolis. So we need to keep that in mind, even in thinking about a number of these things. In 1 Samuel 20, verse 6, the village of Bethlehem is called an ear, a city. So it's not just Jerusalem that can be a city, a little place like Bethlehem. What is more, Judges 10, verse 4, describes Havot Yair as a city. And that actually means a tent camp. Tent camp. They don't tempt people there. It's a tent camp. Interesting. So the word city already should cause us a little bit of pause. It can refer to a fortified city, but it can also be something smaller. Also, Joshua 7 verse 5 and 8:29 refer to the gate of Ai. And we need to remember that in the ancient world, a gate was not simply designed for fortification. A lot of things happen in a gate. We have places here. You see, it was a receiving place for officials, you know, like a formal area, like a parade ground almost, a general gathering area, forum for public discussion, a place for juridical action, a marketplace, a place for cultic activities. Worship of some kind could happen in a gate. So just because we have a gate mentioned at AI doesn't mean we're necessarily dealing with large fortifications. And even the title king should not automatically make us think of a royal acropolis. A lot of junior military officials went by this title, melech in Hebrew. There are, though, a few other textual clues that speak to the size of Ai. Again, we said literally it means the ruin. And throughout Joshua 7 and 8, it's even written with the definite article. It's not called Ai, it's called the Ai. You know, the ruin. Well, that's kind of strange. The text would seem to be making explicit that Ai was a ruin, albeit one that was being utilized by a military detachment. Now, it's noteworthy that Ai alone is given a locating phrase in Joshua. It's described as being near Bethel in 12 verse 9. And presumably, this is to prevent readers from identifying Ai with any of the other ancient ruins that dotted the landscape. But the thing with Ai, its importance lay not in its size. We can debate about that. It could be Makatir and it's plenty strong, but that's not really what's significant, but rather its strategic location. Because anyone wishing to invade the hill country or the central Benjamin Plateau first needed to capture Bethel. And in order to capture Bethel, you had to capture the ruin or Ai that was guarding the road to Bethel. It was an absolute prerequisite for capturing Bethel. And so Ai's close ties to Bethel are made explicit in Joshua 8:17, which says, "Not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who did not go out after Israel." Right? Whatever Ai's doing, Bethel seems to be following suit, which would make sense if this is your front detachment of military guards. What is more, the text leads us to view as Ai as some type of a well-defended guard post, although one that was modestly staffed. The spies tell Joshua in Joshua 7:3, "Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few." That's what they're saying about Ai, right? We don't need to send all the entire infantry up there. It's not that big of a place. And though most English translations say that Israel sent 3,000 soldiers up to fight Ai, the Hebrew word eleph is often used in military context to refer to a fighting unit of perhaps 15 to 20 soldiers, which could help to explain why the death of 36 Israelite soldiers in Joshua 7 verse 5 was such a devastating defeat. Right? If they truly sent 3,000 soldiers up, you would think 36 is a mere 0.1%, 0.01% rather, of their fighting force. But instead, 36 deaths of a smaller military detachment could have been a defeat of closer to 60%. So do you see how, again, reading the text closely, in light of some of these challenges, but rereading the text starts to point us toward thinking about other possibilities here. In sum, what we see is that when we read the Bible carefully, avoid romantic overstatements that often show up in Sunday school materials, we can find nothing at Etel that conflicts with the text of Joshua 7:8. If AI is one of these smaller sites, that's exactly what we would expect from the text. And if there was a larger detachment there that was staffed and was more significantly destroyed and will be evident, that's all fine too. It may be that AI is located at Kirbet El Makatir, and that could accommodate an interpretation of Joshua 7-8 that envisions a bigger battle. But the key is that the text of Joshua 7-8 doesn't demand that reading. And so once again, the critics are put on the defense, right? Not only must they settle the dating debate, they also now need to settle the location debate. And once they've done that, they need to settle the debate over the size and scope of the AI confrontation. But at every turn, we have solid defensible alternatives, all of which continue to affirm the historicity and reliability and nature of the Old Testament. All right. I just put a map up here where you can see Makatir is up in here. We're kind of looking, Makatir is right here. We're looking south, and this would have been El Biray. Down here is where the other Bethel location would be. But you could see there's even talk about how they would go up between Bethel and Ai, and how this little wadi would very much hide a few detachments of soldiers. So a lot of possibilities here. Anyway, well, I've kept you 5 minutes over even. So any final questions or anything like that?
It isn't really a question. Somebody just mm-hmm. contribution. Tell Stenton the kind of defensive structure in Colossus,
mm-hmm. Colossus
that allowed for the Tel to accumulate. For example, Tel Megiddo, which contains 20 cities and was originally 100 feet high.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The sorry. Yeah. As they would build up, it was intentional because the higher it got, the more defensible it became. So that was the question was pointing out how Tells have a military component to them as well. You know, the higher up you get, the more those revetment or glacis can repel attackers. So, yeah, thank you. Well, let me close in prayer. You can stay a few minutes if you have any questions, and we'll go from there. Heavenly Father, thank you for, again, a chance to open your word this evening. Guide us as we go our separate ways and watch over us in all that we do. Hear our prayer for Jesus' sake. Amen.